people just do too much too quickly and then blame the tools when they do too much, right? So it's kind of like, I don't know, metaphorically, if I was like cooking a family meal and then I just decided to use every pot and pan I have and every ingredient in the fridge and then blame all the food and all the pots and pans for the meal not coming out great. But I feel that metaphorically, like in automation, people will just like try to automate anything that moves and then quickly get frustrated and really kind of like have to start small and go with the most important thing.
Welcome to the Test Automation Experience, a show that revolutionizes industry standards, propelling engineering practices to unprecedented heights by harnessing the wisdom of industry titans. Hey, Jason Huggins, what's your best automation advice?
I would say don't let anyone say something is impossible. It's definitely possible. It's just a matter of time and budget. But what gets really annoyed is when someone says, oh, you can't do that. So at least around me, don't ever say you can't do that.
Do you have some specific example that comes to mind?
Actually, any invention that came up, it was because someone said, that's impossible. You can't do that. So shockingly, in 2004, someone said like, oh yeah, you can't test JavaScript. So there goes the next 20 years of my life there. I guess I look at myself as more of like a toolsmith kind of a thing, which is highly adjacent to testing, but it's kind of like a complementary thing. I help testers test, if that makes sense.
I love what you said, by the way. I believe in exactly the same thing, that nothing is impossible. I heard a really great saying. I don't remember from who, but it went something like, the day before something is a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea.
There's also a great quote, and I apologize to anyone who knows the quote, and I'm butchering it, and I think it's attributed to Kennedy, but basically like all progress in the world is, like to do anything new is kind of irrational. So any progress comes from irrational people, right? When you see something that should exist and go make that exist, that is not a rational thing to do sometimes. That's a lot of work. That progress takes people kind of doing irrational things sometimes. So you have to get used to being called a fool, I think, to make progress, to work on some of these tools sometimes.
Yeah, that's a really great thought process. Love it. Jason, what do you think is the worst automation mistake people can make?
People just do too much too quickly and then blame the tools when they do too much, right? So it's kind of like, I don't know, metaphorically, if I was like cooking a family meal and then I just decided to use every pot and pan I have and every ingredient in the fridge and then blame all the food and all the pots and pans for the meal not coming out great. But I feel that metaphorically, like in automation, people will just like try to automate anything that moves and then quickly get frustrated and really kind of like have to start small and go with the most important thing. But every step of the way, don't just blindly, okay, well, now that we have this framework in place, let's do it all. Like, no, like you should still be thoughtful about every step that you take. And sometimes I feel like some of the criticisms for these things are, it's like, well, you try to automate literally anything that can move. And of course, that's going to be kind of a tall task if you haven't budgeted the time or resources for it.
Where do you think that comes from? Because I've definitely seen that. And I've seen like good and bad aspects of it working with customers. For example, I've seen customers that will automate everything. And then it's funny, we will come and work with them and we will help them to reduce all of the work that they spend months or years doing because they're complaining that it's unstable or too slow. The feedback is not fast enough. And then I've also encountered customers where we help them to automate reasonable amounts, what makes sense for the times, for the situation, for the company. And then they're unhappy because there is not enough automation and they want more of it. What do you think about all that?
So Simon Stewart, who took over the Selenium project, kind of the leadership of the project, kind of handed off to him and then I split down, right? He had this phrase, he would talk about this thing of like perceived safety versus actual safety. That's an interesting conversational setup for lots of different things, right? Of like, is whatever you're trying to do actually increase the safety of your system? Does it make you feel good, but doesn't actually do anything? So, I don't know. Maybe some of this stuff kind of came up in the context of like, you know, it'd be really specific in the weeds, like headless browsers. Like if you're testing in the headless browser and it's super fast and you get a good test result, is that actual safety or perceived safety? It's like, when you tested it in a browser that your users don't actually use on a daily basis, a thing that doesn't actually, it's headless, right? But it's a really fast result. Taking a step back, there's this thing where you can kind of, there's all these metaphors to attach to testing. And one of them, I look at it as like all of your tests are like climbing gear, like launching an app and having it just work 24/7 so you're not paged at 3 a.m. It's kind of like rock climbing. I think that's what they call it, rock climbing, right? You're at the rock, the climbing wall at the gym, or actually at El Capitan and Yosemite or something. You have to bring some minimum gear with you. Or if you're a total trailblazer, you can just go, you know, free scaling and just go without any gear. But all of your tests are all that safety equipment, right? Again, in this abused metaphor, you literally have all of the weight of all that rope and all of that stuff. It's hard to even get one foot off the ground because you're just literally weighed down, right? Metaphorically, that's just like someone is just doing too much testing. But the reason why they got into that situation is because there's kind of a fear aspect of it, of like, there's a lot on the line, right? They've got a lot of funding, or, you know, it's a really important project and everyone's afraid that if this thing fails, bad things will happen. And that might actually be true. Like, you might actually lose money. But there's a certain point, if you're trying to climb, you have to just do enough testing so it doesn't weigh you down. But then also at the other end of the spectrum, climbing without any safety gear, that's also ridiculously dangerous. But because software development and testing, relatively to, I guess, rock climbing, is a relatively new endeavor, and because it's a kind of invisible, like it's just all ones and zeros on a computer, metaphorically, I'm thinking of like a, you know, someone has enough gear around them that's like the size of a car, right? Like, it's obvious that's too much. Visually, it's obvious. But it's not quite obvious in software testing when you see a directory full of tests. And maybe it becomes more obvious when it's like, well, how long does it take to run them? Like, oh, it takes an hour or something like that. Then you're like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe you're doing too much. And I think the other part of it, again, it's highly related to that, but it's like all of your tests are effectively kind of an insurance policy, right? And just like buying real insurance in the world, you can maybe buy too much, right? You might not know it. You just realize you're just spending spending a lot, right? But if you are very risk averse, have you thought of every possible corner case? You know, if you're really creative, you will think of all of the horrible things that could happen and want to try to buy insurance for that, but maybe not run that against statistics and say, okay, you know, I don't have to get triple insured for getting struck by lightning 5 times, right? That metaphorical struck by lightning 5 times thing, that could show up as some kind of test that someone spent 3 weeks writing.
They're great metaphors. They made sense to me. And it's the first time I've heard testing compared to rock climbing and insurance.
Sometimes if you're not doing anything really, really dangerous, you don't have to have $1 million safety net. But sometimes you need to. Anyways, there's a certain level of like, how much safety do you need? Goes back to Simon's thing. If he was more eloquent about it, the perceived safety versus actual safety, what do you need on those things?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. A last rapid fire question for you, Jason. With now the rapid growth of Gen AI, what do you see as the future of software development?
When ChatGPT came out, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I was like utterly impressed and enjoying every minute of just playing around with this thing. I think someone suggested like, oh yeah, have ChatGPT write a newspaper article like just straight, no humor, just describing the epic boxing match between Kermit the Frog and Optimus Prime, right? Just like throw it a ridiculous prompt. And it just within seconds just wrote out a very, like, yeah, if there was a boxing match between Kermit the Frog and Optimus Prime, that's how it would have played out, right? And it was ridiculous. It reminds me of, you know, being a kid and like playing Mad Libs. You just kind of give it a couple of prompts and you're just like utterly amused by what comes out. And then after a while, everyone made the jump from, okay, that's amazing. Okay, now let's have it analyze SEC filings and write my business plan and write my tests and my code and whatever. And ChatGPT and all the large language models right now belong in the fiction section of the bookstore. It's great for the Muppets, for the Kermit the Frog versus the Optimus Prime. When you want it to write fiction, I mean, it will kind of go like middle of the road. It's not going to be too out there. It's kind of got washed down to not be really truly offensive. Just in the boxing match story, you really have to kind of really demand that it, like, you know, give me some more gory details. And it'll just like, no, this is violence, whatever. When you apply it to nonfiction stuff in the real world, you know, everything that it's good at is now, if it's its best feature that it can make stuff up, that's also simultaneously its worst feature. It makes stuff up and it doesn't know when it's making stuff up. And even when you push it on it, it's parroting back things that look like grammatically correct sentences. And more often than not, they actually are grammatically correct and they almost make sense, but You never know when it's injecting some horribly untrue thing. That's fine when you're expecting fiction, but when you're asking it to tell you the truth, you don't know when it's lying. I think my enthusiasm for playing with it ridiculously, like for a long time, really dropped when I realized that the hallucination, I think that's what they call it, that LLMs are prone to hallucinate. That is like an unsolved problem and a hard to solve problem. And there aren't really a lot of good answers. It almost seemed like a lot of these people just kind of threw it out in the world because it's entertaining, right? And they just put on a warning label saying, oh yeah, don't do this for real stuff, right? A lot of people ignored that. But from my testing hat, it's like, okay, yes, we would all want this magic device to be able to say, here's my website, here's my app, write all of my tests. And that takes 3 seconds, right? But if then I have to spend another 10 hours going through everything to find out where may or may not have made it up some stuff, I'm having to spend, you know, just as much or more effort than if I just wrote the stuff from scratch, right? When you interview somebody, you can kind of ask them their experience and what they know and what they don't know. So when you ask them to maybe write some tests, you kind of know what's in their experience set and what's not. And we don't really often have an opportunity to interview an LLM to say what you're good at, what you're not. And even if we were able to do that and see its resume, it would lie to us half the time, right? So it's the same thing as asking an employee that lied their way into the job, lied their way into the interview, and then you're like, okay, here's a task. It almost feels like you're getting the same results, right? From a unqualified employee, it's the same thing with unqualified LLM. I'm waiting for someone to conclusively solve the hallucination problem in Gen AI. Then everything that everyone is predicting will actually happen when it, like, okay, now it'll all write the tests and whatever. But because of the hallucination problem in Gen AI right now, and it's not really a solved problem, it belongs in the fiction section for now. I would not be so bold as to make the prediction that that will never, you know, change, right? The hallucination problem makes it a fun thing to have, but I get very concerned if someone tries to say, like, we're going to do some real stuff and, like, fire all the humans that would be in charge of making sure it didn't just make stuff up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no, it makes total sense. You can't trust it. And so when you need it to do work that has to be trusted, how can you? And so then there has to be someone to verify that work. And right now, we are the arbiters to decide what is true and what is not true based on our context.
Over time, we'll have better ideas of what we can trust these things for and what we can't. But it's so new that it's dangerous to use it for anything, quote unquote, for real, right? Unless, again, you're giving it a job like make me something that is utterly fictional and entertain me. It's off the charts good for that right now.
I did try to use it for different kind of contexts, like having it build, test, and deploy a web app. It was a presentation I did last year at one of the conferences. And it actually did do a pretty decent job at like doing simple stuff like building a basic React app. It was able to walk me through and build it and write some tests. It wrote like 4 tests just by me asking it to write tests. 2 of them passed, 2 of them failed. The 2 that failed were failed because I was a really poor locator that it tried to use. On CI, it didn't do such a good job. But I found it interesting because I would give it like a 50 out of 100 score on that attempt, but it got the app and some of the tests right, which was pretty cool in my point of view.
The problem of when to use the LLMs and the AI stuff and when not to use it, it feels very similar to the problem with software estimation. Like, how long is it going to take you to do a thing, right? And no one really knows when you're being asked to do something, whether it's going to take a day or 5 years, right? I literally remember, like, I think what became Selenium was like, oh, we need to test this feature. Seemed kind of complicated. I didn't realize it was going to be a project that had includes, you know, conferences and books and hundreds of people and whatever. It just seemed like the small task. And only when we got into it, we realized we were inventing something brand new, right? It all comes down to, has somebody done it before? Then it's easy to estimate, right? So if you were hiring people come over to install an air conditioner, that's been done before. You can buy an air conditioner and it takes a certain amount of effort to pick it up, put it in the pickup truck, put it over, connect it to some pipes. That's been done before. That can be estimated. But that's completely different than asking somebody to invent an air conditioner from scratch. But the way software works, it's hard to tell whether you're asking to install an air conditioner or invent an air conditioner from scratch, because they're all just ones and zeros. And the line between what's actually a new invention and a new add-on and just like an installation of a plugin So it becomes kind of weird when it's a like a React app and it was maybe half good. That's been done before. And it's actually kind of regurgitating all the code that's out there, all the sample code. And it was good at basically copy pasting and kind of giving you something. And you can tweak things around the side. In my example, I can get to these, I think they call them error loops. There's all this new vocabulary for talking with the gen AI stuff. Like there's jailbreaking and all various stuff. But a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to come up with some image product mockups for the stuff that I'm working on now. And, you know, if you take the shape of a phone, I had this idea to prompt the gen AI, the image gen stuff of like, hey, basically like give me a race car bed, but replace the mattress with a phone. Because I want to make a phone holder that looks like a race car, right? And then I thought like, oh, okay, people have already designed race car beds and there's a big rectangle in the middle. This is a classic Gen AI thing to swap out one thing, change one thing, whatever. So it did. It always put two little pillows on top of, like it got the iPhone in there. It got a home screen and everything. It was a race car bed. It was amazing. But it always put pillows in there. And then I would just say, hey, that's great. Awesome. Remove the pillows. And it could not. It would even say, here's another version of the image. Remove the pillows for you. I got you. And the pillows are still there. You have to kind of think about it. I'm telling it to take this thing from its training data. And all of the sample images were beds. And all beds have pillows on them. And it could not figure out how to do anything. It was just get rid of all the pillows was too far out of its creative non-brain, whatever it was. So that was already outside the realm of something that an AI really knew how to do. So we're all collectively figuring out, almost reverse engineering, what it was trained on, right? And maybe that's the scary thing about jobs in the future is like probably a majority of jobs, you're not doing a new thing. You're doing something that's been done before. It just needs to be done again and again and again. My particular job is always doing these new things. So I'm bumping into these limits, not always, but like I am getting more frustrated than not asking these AI things because it can't help me with the new thing I'm trying to do. We're all collectively trying to figure out what it's good for and what it's not. And the AI vendors are not really telling us that distinction. They want to say it's good for everything. So collectively as customers of these things, we have to, and especially testers, we are kind of exploring in real time, you know, the limits of this stuff.
So Jason, one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show was I saw you made a tweet or a LinkedIn post about Tapster and Valet. And I was so curious about that. And we're going to look at that in a moment. But the other thing you mentioned, which I think is really cool for the audience to hear, and even for myself to talk to you directly about this, was you mentioned how Selenium, it was supposed to be a little thing that you were going to do, automate some JavaScript, and all of a sudden it turns into this massive project now used by millions of people all across the world. Can you tell us the story of Selenium and how it came to be?
There was a point, and it's hard to realize that this was actually a point in time, but in 2003, 2004, the browsers were not very compatible with each other. So if you'd use some fancy JavaScript in one browser, it would be utterly broken. This was also the time where people would put little icons on their website saying, this site is best viewed in this browser and this version, which sounds ridiculous now. But also, we're actually kind of in a similar vibe right now where Google Chrome has 80, 90% of market share. At the time, it was Internet Explorer had 80% market share. And so some people made very pragmatic decisions and just only supported Internet Explorer. Of course, but if you were part of a group of people who did not have Internet Explorer because they were buying these like hipster Apple computers, right, and had Safari on it, or you were a Linux nerd and you had Firefox, I think the first version that Selenium supported, maybe this is like a little footnote to history, was like 0.9.3 or 0.9.4. So before version one of Firefox, at the time it was just Mozilla, and Firefox was like a kind of a soft fork of the Mozilla browser. So cross-browser stuff was a problem. And so the professional thing to do was not use JavaScript. You were a good professional programmer if you didn't have any JavaScript in your web apps at all, period. And then the other funny thing is like this is becoming fashionable again to do everything server-side. Server-side rendering, you know, if you're doing like a static site, right? You just have it all pre-rendered, stored on the website. It's all fast to load and nothing magical or interesting or interactive happens on the browser, period. So if you've got some data to enter, you do a little form, you click a button that sends the whole thing back to the server. The server does all the magic and it sends it back to the client. The context of where Selenium came from was it was designed to test a time and expense app. ThoughtWorks was the company that I was at the time. My mission was to make a time and expense app. So if you're a consulting company, your product basically is the billable hours of all your consultants. So they have to go in once a week to enter how many hours they billed and to enter their expense reports, right? So a lot of data entry, it's no one loves doing that. But the specific mission that we had was around that time, we were growing a lot internationally. So maybe before that, everyone was in the Chicago office basically, or, you know, close. So the ping times between their laptop, wherever they were, and the Chicago servers was kind of low. But now we had a ton of employees in London and India and whatever. And they were, some people I think might have even like quit the company because they were like, their number one complaint was, it takes too long to enter my timesheet. And it's like, it sounds ridiculous, but it's like, that was, it was that painful. Wow. Anyway, so our mission was to make this fast. You know, we couldn't take away the pain of having to do your timesheets and expense reports. But if you have to do it, at least let's make it a non-horrible experience, right? So this has to be fast. So we create a little mini form that they can fill out. Let's say in the expense report, we give them 10 lines. And if you need more lines of like to enter more stuff, the classic professional thing to do is to click a button for more rows, tell the server, I need more rows, and then it'll upload all your data and then send you back all the same data that you just sent it to it with 10 more blank rows. And maybe in a different context, that would be fine. That's how we would have done it, whatever. But if you're specifically trying to imagine what the latency of that request from India back to Chicago was, just because we're doing it as a web app, different than the previous version, it was not going to be fast enough. Even though we're using this brand new webby thing, we didn't really solve the problem. Anyway, so I noticed like, oh, wait a second. You know, if we use this crazy JavaScripty thing, if we just cloned the previous row in this form, we could avoid a round trip to the server and we could do everything super fast. Like I did a little prototype and everything was like super, like, again, this is mind blowing to people who've never really, again, all the professionals I'm surrounded by were not using JavaScript. So I show them a little bit of what JavaScript can do. Everyone was kind of immediately dismissive, but it's like, well, wait a second, but that's the crazy bad JavaScript you're not allowed to use because you're a professional and professionals don't use JavaScript. The specific line was, you know, you can't test it. There's no testing tool to test this stuff. And then I was like, okay, that sounds wrong. So then you kind of go to do some analysis and you're like, oh, well, there are some testing tools, but they're IE only. And like, okay, that kind of makes sense because IE is 80% of the market. And so they kind of did the pragmatic thing. But we've got all these crazy consultants using these brand new Apple computers. It seems like that's going to be a big thing. I mean, this is 2004 before Apple was obviously Apple, before the iPhone, whatever. We really need to support multiple browsers, multiple operating systems. And yes, it was buggy between different, like if you did a little bit of JavaScript in just the wrong way, it would break between browsers. You could almost say that Selenium and jQuery, if you know your JavaScript history, we actually were trying to solve the same problem. jQuery solved it by all the cross-browser problems. They try to make one unifying API that, and then under the hood, it had a carve out or a, there's a fancy word, plugin, proxy fill, whatever it is for, okay, we're in AI, do it this way. If we're in Firefox, do it this way. We solved it by like, well, you just write a test and run it in all the browsers and you developer just come back to me with some other version and we're just going to keep running the tests until they're passed on all the browsers, right? So for a good month, we did it the professional way and there was no JavaScript. And then what do you know? It was slow and that was a bummer. Anyway, so then we decided, you know what? I'm going to put my foot down. We're going to do it this JavaScript way. But we still had this problem of it's, yes, there's no testing tool that can let us be able to test this fancy feature in IE and Mozilla. And so that was kind of like the marching orders for whatever became Selenium was two browsers and you're testing some web app that uses JavaScript. It has to have the ability to click around in a browser. I think some of the other tools that were available at the time were headless in the same sense of you would just make an HTTP request to the server. You would just grab the text response and then do assertions on that. So you're not really doing anything interactively. You're not rendering the page. You're just doing some text analysis on that. You could do a whole bunch of assertions on the text. The source code of the page looked good, but that doesn't really give you a good signal of like, Like, were you able to actually load the page, click a button, go to the next page, right? I wanted to be able to see that. So it was basically replicate the user experience, like, as close as possible to how a user would open a browser, enter a URL, type text to in a field, click a button. I made this joke before, but it's like my entire career, shockingly, has been telling a computer or a robot to click a button. And you'd be surprised that this is not a solved problem yet. People are always coming up with new kinds of buttons to click. And apparently they're challenging to have a robot do that, whatever. A human will just like, oh yeah, there's a button, I'll click it. And telling the robot to do the exact same thing, that is a career. So Selenium was like, we're going to render a page and it's going to click a button. Professionals, well-paid consultants at very expensive consulting firms were arguing over the feasibility of making software that could click a button in a web page, all because it used JavaScript, or all because you were using a hipster operating system and browser. A month later, we had kind of this prototype. And then I always thought my claim to fame was going to be this time and expense app. Like, that was really gearing up. Like, this is a really cool thing. We did a huge evaluation. It's going to be this great thing. We're going to open source. Every consulting company in the world is going to be using our awesome time and expense app. And then over time, people were coming to my office. They wanted to check out this amazing button clicker thing. Out of the blue, I got like invited to like talk at a conference or something like that. And I was like, how did they even know about this? Like, but it was because some of the consultants were using it. Like, hey, you should go check out Jason's cool little testing tool. It was right place, right time. We were a bunch of consultants, but all the consultants that worked at ThoughtWorks, this was right back before, like right when Agile as a methodology was taking off. And then anyone who instantly, viscerally reacts and hates Agile now, I'm talking like early Agile when it wasn't horrible and they were writing books and it really was better than the previous way to make software. So we had a lot of outspoken people who, you know, famous, they had blogs, and you know, Martin Fowler would just joined the company, very famous computer scientist. And so all these ideas that are totally commonplace now, like continuous integration, the very first continuous integration server was actually created at ThoughtWorks. Right at the time, people were trying to talk about how to do software correctly. Source control was a brand new idea. Continuous, and the source control that leads to continuous integration that then checks out your tests and your code and runs all that stuff, right? So Selenium fit into, like, this was one huge piece of this puzzle that collectively as an industry, we're trying to figure out what are all the pieces, became my, what do you call it, propaganda army for getting kind of the message out, right? It was a very cool place to be at that time. Again, late, mid 2000s. But also, for a good 6 months, we were testing this little JavaScript feature. But I was still the crazy, it was still an unprofessional thing to do, to use JavaScript, right? But then Google came out with Gmail and Google Maps, and everyone overnight went from JavaScript is horrible to, okay, fine, it's still horrible, but it's amazing and you can do amazing things with it. But how do we test it? And so then Selenium had a kind of like a 6 month head start on everybody else. The rest is history.
Wasn't Mercury QuickTest Pro around at that time as well?
Right. I did not know that actually testing was a career. There were books about it, famous people who had opinions about testing. I knew none of this. All of that, I was just a developer with a testing problem and just try to solve it, right? So I didn't know that Mercury existed. I didn't know there were companies that were trying to solve testing problems. Google was around there, right? But it was only a couple of years old at that point, right? So the only reason why I even knew about the existence of QuickTest Pro was because Brett Petticord, almost the same month that we were starting to work on Selenium, he joined. And he was a famous tester or developer who is famous for having opinions about testing. He wrote a book, I think it's Lessons Learned in Testing. We should probably put it in the show notes, his book. But he came in as a famous tester, right? Or a developer who can test, whatever. He had a particular project that he was working on at the time, WTR, web testing in Ruby. That became water, WATIR. Brett's the one who said to me, like, hey, you know, if you keep working on this Selenium thing, like, you could take on Mercury. Like, this could be a Mercury killer someday. And of course, when he said that to me, I had no idea what he was talking about. I just was trying to reply to him how I accidentally named it Selenium. I was really just spending this whole time researching what Mercury was, and more specifically trying to come up with like a witty reply. And at some point I made this name association from like Mercury to mercury poisoning. And then I started Googling a lot of, this is what all the Googling was, the cure for mercury poisoning. The setup for my reply to him was like, well, if you really want to kill mercury, you should take these selenium supplements from this doctor who was obviously a quack doctor. It was obviously they were trying to sell these supplements, but their argument was, if you have a dental filling, you know, that's made out of mercury. You're getting mercury poisoning because of that. So, and it's going to be hard to get that mercury out of you now that it's there. But this doctor was saying, take these selenium supplements and that will be this counterbalance to the mercury that's in your body. So I sent this now famous email to Brett and then also Powell Hammett. He was like the head of open source at ThoughtWorks. And I just said like, hey, well, if you want to kill selenium, you should, you know, take these supplements from this guy. But about my project, here are all the reasons why I think we should call it Check Engine. And I was internally calling it the Check Engine Project. It was going to be complementary to the cruise control project that with the continuous integration thing that ThoughtWorks was known for. This was going to be, oh, we're going to go with a car dashboard theme. This will be the check engine. It's going to be an engine that checks things. Like, oh, that's pretty clever. And they're like, oh, if the light, you know, if the light, the tests go red, it's like your check engine light going off. I was extremely clever with this whole email of both my witty reply to Brett's and all my reasons for why we should call this whole thing check engine. And then I got no reply, just complete silence. People just started coming to my office asking about selenium, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I think what Paul, without telling me, just said, oh yeah, selenium, that's it, that's the name. So the way I describe it is I accidentally named it selenium just because I was just trying to write. It was basically like I was just trying to write a dad joke, and it just everything got out of control.
I've heard the story before, not as in depth as I have from you. So for me, as an expert and a fan, I am super excited to listen to this. So I'm sure many people will.
I didn't know what I was doing. I was confident enough in the problem in front of me, but I had no delusions of grandeur that I was creating this epic thing. I did not realize I was creating a thing that would lead to other people writing books and there'd be conferences and there's these podcasts and all this stuff like that. I just had this really annoying problem. So sometimes when you're just kind of like, you're early in your career and you're just trying to figure out like what to work on, look for good problems to solve. And then it's almost like maybe like a color commentary on top of that is like, go find the ones that those problems that either people are running away from or say it's impossible or whatever. If you can solve those, it's going to be not exactly high risk, high reward. It's ones and zeros. It's not a very high risk profession here, or at least shouldn't be. Again, I was completely unaware that testing was an industry with books and speakers and all of that stuff. So if you focus on interesting problems to work on, then you too can be interviewed 20 years later. I didn't intentionally try to make this mercury killer. That was just the joke.
You didn't intentionally try to kill them, which is funny, but you kind of did kill them, the selenium.
At the first Selenium conference, 2011, it was a couple of years later. So the first version of Selenium was like 2004, right? I was doing a little bit of research right before kind of opening the conference. It's hard to figure out what market share is when you're comparing something that people spend money on and that can be tracked in the economy versus something that's free and that can be downloaded. My equalizer was job postings. And just in that month, that's when Selenium job listings were surpassed QuickTest Pro. And then it was kind of funny. Then a year or two after that, Mercury renamed it to something else.
UFT.
Yeah. So it's like we beat it and then we're going to just change the game right here.
Yeah. All right. So you created Selenium. And then at some point, you kind of stepped away from the project, handed it over to Simon Stewart, and you all merged it into Selenium WebDriver, and it continued down the path of history. And then you co-founded Sauce Labs.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that and also why you named it Sauce Labs.
Right. Creating Sauce Labs, I was at Google, and it was interesting. Both Simon and I started our respective projects. I started Selenium 2004. He started WebDriver as a completely, utterly separate project. I want to say 2006, maybe. I saw an early version of that. We were both at ThoughtWorks. He was in ThoughtWorks UK, and I was in ThoughtWorks Chicago. I actually got to see an early version of WebDriver. I got to go to the London office to go hang out for a week. They had an internal conference. Simon did a presentation, an internal presentation about this WebDriver thing. And I was not impressed. Like, oh, we solved all those problems. You know, I was only like, still in my 20s, whatever. Still, but very cocky and like, oh man, you don't know what you're doing. But a year later, I'm now at Google, now working on this thing called the Selenium Farm. Like, and we're doing testing for Gmail and Maps of all teams, whatever. Anyway, that's a story unto itself. But Google had this they did this testing conference. The first one was LTAC, London Test Automation Conference. And then the second one was renamed to Google Test Automation Conference. And I spoke at the first one and that one. The second one was in New York City. And the reason for the setup was I gave a talk. Ironically, actually, if you go look that up, that was my demo at GTAC, New York City, 2007. My Amazon AWS account was only 24 hours old right before that talk. And I gave a demo about running a couple of browsers in the cloud and how to explain to an audience of Googlers and other people of like, there's this cloud thing and you can run browsers in the cloud and it's going to be awesome. And here, let me give you a live demo. And I actually got some kind of sarcastic claps because my demo from the previous year utterly failed. This version, this live demo worked. So I got some surprise applause from that. That was my talk of like cloud testing. I think it's going to be big. But Simon's talk was about this WebDriver thing. Over that course of that year, between the first demo that I saw and the Simon's demo of WebDriver at GTAC 2007, it was amazing. He solved all the problems. And it was obvious to me, this was the actual Selenium killer. Like, I could go into all the nerdy details, and I won't, except for one little detail. Everything that Selenium did was all limited by the security context of the browser. Like, a lot of the magic of Selenium was it was running JavaScript in a web page, and so it could click on buttons, right? But it was limited by the security context of what a browser could and could not do. You fast forward to all these years later, Cypress is a particular tool that's doing the exact same thing that the first version of Selenium, my quote-unquote version of Selenium, was doing. But I knew all of the limits. Like, just one example, like if an alert box or a print dialog box popped up on the screen, JavaScript can trigger that. But Selenium, at the time, couldn't click OK on a print dialog box because that is owned by the operating system, not by the browser. And because of browser security, it couldn't break out. Like, if Selenium was able to break out of that security context, that would be a security hole and that would be a bad thing, right? And this is the thing. Architecturally, the projects were fundamentally, under the hood, completely built differently. So there was no way at this point, a couple of years, Selenium was only 3 years old at the time, but there was no way we could fix it at this point. It's like hard to refactor a car into a plane. You can't just add wings to it and it can fly. Like, no, you built a car. You can make it a better car, but it's harder to switch it to a completely different thing. Simon came at this from this operating system level to be able to do anything. So architecturally, he was not limited. If a print dialog popped up, he could tell the script to go click it and a bunch of different things that were like that, right? So architecturally, fundamentally, under the hood, it was better. Right. But it was this weird thing where at the time Selenium was now ascendant and the cool thing and everyone was using that. I knew all the things that Selenium sucked at and was never, ever going to get good at. We could probably get away with like, oh, yeah, you can't do that. Or again, I know some projects now that are like, oh, yeah, you can do all these weird workarounds to get around this architectural limitation. And so I kind of went up to Simon and kind of confessed to him that like, hey, like everything that I just saw now is like mind blowing, amazing. And is basically like, should be the future of the Selenium project. And I don't know what his opinion at that time was. I don't think he was expecting me to say that. He was probably, I think it's more often than not, you have put a couple of developers in the room. So you're at a testing conference. Everyone's very proud and very confident. And, you know, it's just going to be, the assumption would probably be that we are going to be enemies, right? Or frenemies or something like that, right? But I was so convinced, like he had checked every box of everything I could possibly think of it were problems with Selenium. So I kind of like, proposed this idea like, hey, we should, at this point, Selenium had these architectural limits, but definitely had this brand. Like it was like people were testing stuff with it, right? It was really popular inside Google and it was whatever. Like, yeah, how does Google do testing? Like, oh, they're using Selenium. Both sides of it became kind of like this good idea, right? Selenium needed a version 2, a better architecture to, you know, get its next growth curve, whatever, right? And Simon, if we decided to be friends and not enemies, like he could inherit now a user base and developers and adoption. And if we kind of play this out correctly, like that's just an awesome future for the web driver, as opposed to fighting against Selenium. It's like, no, this is the future of Selenium. It's going to be, that's an easier thing to have. Well, easier said than done, right?
Let me know your thoughts on it. Seems like you lean in that direction. My general feeling on life is collaboration over competition seems to be the approach where typically everyone can win when they collaborate, but in competition, there's typically a loser and a winner.
not to pick on the playwright team specifically, but just kind of to put this out there. So the way where Selenium Project is now, there's a W3 standard, and we're trying to get the browser vendors. Why is that a thing? Why is there a W3C standard, right? That's a whole story right there, which is an important story, actually, which the playwright people specifically need to hear. What I'm trying to say is, in this case, competition is good. They are pushing the Selenium Project in a good way, right? So again, fundamentally under the hood, maybe let's say the flaw of the web driver, of Simon's approach, even though it fixed a whole bunch of problems with the way Selenium used to be, the current problem is that you are making these HTTP requests, right? And you make a request, there's a whole bunch of headers, a whole bunch of stuff comes back. Ironically, it kind of goes back to the original problem that I was trying to solve, that like latency is a recurring theme. Like people will always like something that is faster than not, right? And so the playwright team kind of realized, you know, if you could use this, was it the Chrome debug protocol? It's faster. Like it literally, because you are sending fewer bytes back and forth, it's faster than a stateless HTTP connection, which is the WebDriver protocol. It all has these trade-offs, right? So the WebDriver protocol, it's easy to write a new client for a new platform or a new browser because it's just HTTP, and those are easy to make clients and scripts support, right? It's harder to support the gnarly Chrome debug protocol under the hood. But jumping ahead towards the future, you know, the version 4 of Selenium, I think now is the Selenium 4 bidirectional protocol. That is a lesson learned from what the Puppeteer team and the Playwright team was doing on driving browsers at the, like kind of this different protocol level. And so I think that maybe this is perhaps a warning to all of the potential competitors to Selenium. It's like, we're not your enemy. We would love to have a conversation. In a certain way now, Selenium is kind of like the Python programming language. If there is a good idea out there in some other language, I've noticed this in the history of the Python programming language, they will steal any good idea and bring it into the language. There's things like list comprehensions, type annotations, or, you know, decorators, all kinds of interesting ideas that came from all kinds of different languages. And after enough time of it being kind of tried out in some other language, if it's kind of good and popular, Python will totally bring it in and make it Pythonic. Like they will very eagerly steal all good ideas. The English language itself will steal any word from any language and make it English if it's a cool, awesome, interesting word, right? English as a language has no problems with that versus other languages like French, where it's like, no, like you can't do that. So Selenium is at this point kind of like, if there's a good idea out there, if you've come up with your Selenium killer and it's using a particular protocol or a particular thing, watch out. Like we will take that idea. And again, we're not Amazon here. Like we're not being evil. It's like, we're going to take it and then also not make any money on it as this Selenium project. This isn't like an Amazon taking your project thing, but this is like Python. Like if there's a good idea that's out there, it will get incorporated into the project, which is happening now with the bidirectional protocol. Like I think that is a thing that got played out with Puppeteer and Playwright. And that's like, oh, that's a good idea. That should be in the Selenium project. Like there's no philosophical reason why we're just going to like just, you know, punch the air and say, no, you must do it our way because we are always right.
That point came across. Now, back to my original question.
My co-founder, John, I think technically named it Sauce. I didn't really have any good ideas for the actual name. So he named it Sauce Labs. And I think it was Sauce Labs because like sauce.com was taken, but Sauce Labs, that was kind of a trendy thing to just add labs to it, whatever. And now you can own the .com. I think if you ask him, there's this phrase called a backronym, right? Like you have the word and then you come up with the acronym after the fact. It's an after the fact backronym. And there's two versions of this, right? So one of them is we're going to put Selenium on the cloud. The way I like to describe this to anyone who would listen is that I personally love to throw more hardware at the problem, right? So if you've got 100 tests and they all take a minute, yes, you could go get a PhD and come up with some really fancy math algorithms to figure out how to optimize this. And this is probably what the Playwright team did, right? But at the time, I'm a fan of like, well, if it's 100 tests and they all take a minute, let's get 100 machines. This is a very googly mindset, right? Like, we'll just get more computers, duh, right? And so in that context, there was this phrase of like, well, what we're doing, it's like Selenium on steroids. That's like what we're doing here. So I think what happened, that was probably the first version of Sauce as a word you would say out loud, like we're Selenium on steroids, SOS. But then that became a better iterated version of that was, oh, well, what other words that sound like sauce that literally you'd spell it differently, from SOS to SAUCE. This was the utterly contrived invention that also does not belong on the website. But SAUCE is a backronym for SAUCE. That is an acronym for Selenium Acceleration Using Cloud Execution, which is cringy and horrible. Selenium steroids is actually a little bit of a punchier, it's actually kind of a better thing there. I think that's the thing. I had lunch with him when I was still at Google. I was wanting to start a startup, and I was about to leave Google actually and move back to Chicago. If I wanted to move back to Chicago and stay with Google, I was going to have to like reapply for my job. There wasn't like my job. It was only in Mountain View and not in Chicago. So I was already kind of leaving Google at that point. And then I met my co-founder. And so the way I talked about what I was working on at Google, there's a Selenium farm. We have like these internal clients and we're doing the Selenium stuff at scale. And it's just like this big thing, right? Lots of computers. It's a lot to manage and companies are paying for this stuff, whatever. So I think from just perhaps his own word cloud of all the random words I was saying, he came up with this like, oh yeah, Selenium acceleration using cloud execution. But now that it's more than just Selenium, there's all these other tools, but I think it would be convenient, you know, if you were looking for future internal names of, you know, that acronym can stay true if you also start with an S word, right? I don't know. Security acceleration, whatever it is, but that's the story.
That's awesome. All right. So Selenium, then come SAUCE Labs, which is Selenium Acceleration on Cloud Execution.
Yeah, we're jumping through the years here. We haven't. Yeah, I have to push my current stuff. Right. Thank you to everyone who's stuck with the podcast so far.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you all. This I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to the Test Automation Experience. If you want more content like this, head over to our YouTube channel and be sure to subscribe so you never miss another amazing episode.